Good afternoon. I call this hearing to order and welcome to our witnesses. A good friend of the committee's, the Honorable Bill Evanina, former director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. He is the founder and CEO of the Evanina Group, and in many ways, a lot of what we're going to be talking about today, he's worked on with this members of this committee on for many, many years. Anna Puglisi, sorry, Anna, senior fellow at the Center for Security and Emerging Technology, or CSET, at Georgetown University, and on WebEx, Matt Pottinger, the distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institute and former deputy national advisor, double national security advisor, I think, at the White House. Today, the committee will examine the counterintelligence threats posed by the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party. We will look at the PRC's activities within the United States as it works to acquire critical U.S. technologies and intellectual property, hack into the U.S. cyber networks, and conduct influence operations to shape narratives to be more favorable to the PRC and the CCP. I hope the witnesses will also discuss their recommendations for better countering the CCP's efforts in the United States. Now, the Intelligence Committee, as Senator Burr often reminded us, doesn't normally hold open hearings, but Vice Chairman Rubio and I believe this story needs to get out to the American public. Several years ago, the committee, in a bipartisan way, thanks in part to Senators Rubio, Burr, Cornyn, and Collins, convened a series of classified sessions with leaders from the intelligence community and leaders from the private sector, tech, finance, venture capital, academia, to brief them on efforts by the CCP to target their industries. I've wanted for some time to take those briefs and move them into an open hearing so that the U.S. public, including the private sector, our academic institutions, our media outlets, and others can better understand these threats and how we, as a society, can counter them. Because the truth is, the government cannot counter the CCP's actions all by itself. One of the most important areas that I hope the witnesses will address is how China is focusing on targeting key U.S. technologies for both acquisition and development. These include aerospace, advanced manufacturing, AI, biotech, data analytics, semiconductors, renewables, all in order to ensure PRC's future dominance in these areas. We saw this play out in many ways, and again, I think this committee was one of the first to notice the CCP's efforts in their pursuit of 5G technology with backing of Huawei. And I'm proud that this committee's work in sounding the alarm on the threat of what would happen if networks all around were reliant on a sole source Chinese provider in 5G. That would threaten both our national security and our allies' security. I hope the witnesses will also address how the CCP is using a variety of methods to acquire these capabilities, including cyber and traditional espionage, but also using a lot of the tools of business, joint ventures, acquisitions, mergers, and increasingly strategic investments by firms that at the end of the day are answerable to the Communist Party leadership in Beijing. They're also creating a series of partnerships with universities, in many ways, oftentimes luring some of those universities into trips or sinecures that sometimes put that academic research at risk. We also know increasingly we're seeing their malign influence efforts to affect policy decisions that we in the Congress make. Matter of fact, the FBI has estimated that China's theft of simply American intellectual property, not worldwide, just American intellectual property, runs from between $300 to $600 billion a year. According to the DOJ, 80% of all economic espionage prosecutions brought by the DOJ allege conduct that would benefit the Chinese state. And 60% of all trade secret theft cases have some nexus to China. FBI Director Wray told this committee in April that the Bureau has more than 2,000 operations going on, investigations, that tie back to the Chinese government. And this is one of the most stunning facts he laid out. He opens up a new investigation into Chinese espionage every 10 hours. The director also attested that no other country represents more of a threat to the United States, its economic security, and democratic ideals than China, and that China's ability to influence American institutions is, quote, deep, wide, and persistent. Ceding leadership across these technology sectors would have major repercussions for U.S. economic and national security. Let's not forget that in most ways, since World War II, the United States has led in both scientific research and the development of transformational technologies. It's this leadership that has translated into decades of economic success for U.S. companies and our military capabilities. As part of our technological leadership, the U.S., or like-minded democracies, also set the global standards and protocols for new technology. And many of the times, we can implant in those standards, in those protocols, our values. Democracy, transparency, diversity of opinion, and respect for human rights. And that is a long-term value to our country that I don't think is often factored in. I've been frustrated, though, by the frequency by which U.S. companies, in their desire for market access in China, have frankly given up sometimes on those values and sometimes facilitated and enabled the PRC to acquire sensitive U.S. technologies. The idea they can't miss the Chinese market means they make sacrifices going into that market they would make in no other nation in the world. China, in turn, uses these technologies to advance its own illiberal vision, to surveil and control its population, stifle the free flow of information, and repress foreign influence campaigns worldwide. These technologies enable the PRC to suppress dissident and restrict religious groups. We see that whether it's in Xinjiang or in Hong Kong. As we think through what the CCP is doing in the United States, I want to make crystal clear, though, my concerns lie squarely with the president of China, Xi Jinping, and the Chinese Communist Party leaders, not the people of China, and certainly not with Chinese or other Asian Americans who've contributed so much to our society. Our answer to these challenges cannot be to keep talented folks out of the United States. In fact, we've seen in my state of Virginia, Northern Virginia particularly, a technology hotbed, literally 40% of all the startups are started by first-generation Americans. So it is in our national interest to welcome these talented Chinese academics, entrepreneurs, and technologists, and in fact, make it more attractive for them to use their talent to bolster our economy, rather than simply going back to China. This is, again, where our values come into play. And Americans should also be aware that the PRC's pressures and coercion efforts don't stop with the diaspora or Chinese nationals living in the United States. As Senator Rubio will point out, increasingly, the CCP is focused on pressuring U.S. citizens, entities, and businesses across industries to, again, shape a narrative that advances their goals. Even for this hearing, a number of potential witnesses declined to participate in an open format for fear of retribution to themselves or their families. From the PRC's pursuit of critical and sensitive technology to its repression at home and coercion abroad, and its focus on trying to win the technology battle in the 21st century, it's clear that I think our country is facing a new Sputnik moment where we must take steps to remain competitive, especially in technology, and find better ways to strengthen our defenses against the CCP's myriad intelligence, tech acquisition, and foreign influence operations. Because we're back into this kind of semi-hybrid system today, for today's meeting, we will be asking questions by order of seniority, and as Senator King has made clear, with the five-minute rule applying. Thank you. I now turn to the Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. I think you started out by talking about how unusual it is we have these open hearings, and there's a reason for it. The members of this committee on a regular basis review some of the most sensitive intelligence, both intelligence and the products that come from them that this government has available to it. So I think it should send a powerful message when you see that on issue after issue relating to China, issues that some would argue are outside the purview of what this committee has traditionally looked at, technology, academia, influence operations, global diplomacy, industrial policy, that it is members of this committee that you see in the lead on so many issues relating to China. Because the members of this committee have, because of the role they play, have a very unique insight into this horror show that's playing out before our eyes in the 21st century. The title of this hearing is The Long Arm of China. The Long Arm of China is not some futuristic threat. It's already here. China is stealing between $300 and $600 billion a year, $300 to $600 billion a year of American technology and intellectual property. They hack into networks and they take it. They use venture capital funds to buy promising technology startups. They hide their ownership, by the way. They partner with universities on research, and then they steal that research, often research that whose seed funding came from the U.S. taxpayer. They force American companies doing business in China to give the technology over to them. And I think the other thing most people don't realize is China already has tremendous influence and control over what Americans are allowed to say or hear about them or many of the other issues in the world. Hollywood is so desperate, for example, to have their movies shown in China that Hollywood won't make a movie that the China communist censors don't approve. The U.S. corporations are so desperate to have access to the Chinese market that they'll lead costly boycotts of a state, an American state, that passes a law that they don't like, but they don't dare say a word about the fact that as we speak, genocide is taking place against Uyghur Muslims. American companies have actually fired Americans who live in America for saying or writing something that China doesn't like. There's some examples here that are pretty stunning. 2019, China suspended business ties with the NBA because the general manager of the Houston Rockets expressed support for Hong Kong democracy protests. 2019, Apple removed an app that enabled protesters in Hong Kong to organize following CCP pressure. In 2019, an American company, Activision Blizzard, suspended a gamer and took away his prize money for voicing support for Hong Kong protesters. In 2018, Marriott fired an employee that ran a social media account because he liked a Twitter post from a Twitter account applauding Marriott for listing Tibet as a country rather than as part of China, and he was fired after that. 2018, Gap made a shirt with a map of China, and it didn't include Taiwan. They apologized for it, and they removed the shirt from its stores. Now, maybe you think that shirt thing is trivial. I don't think people getting fired is trivial, apps getting trivial, these other things. These are just one of a handful of many. And this is already happening. So in conclusion, I'd say two things. The first is Chairman is absolutely right. This is not about the Chinese people, or especially not about Chinese Americans, okay? My parents came from Cuba. I live in a community filled with Cuban Americans. It would be unfair to blame Cuban Americans for the atrocities of the Cuban regime, and it would most certainly be unfair to blame the Cuban people for the horrifying actions of the regime that controls that enslaved island. Likewise, the biggest opponents of the Chinese Communist Party on the planet happen to be Chinese. Many live here, many in other parts of the world, and many under their oppressive thumb. So this is not about the Chinese people. It is about a Communist Party, and it is time to wake up. Today, China is already carrying out the biggest illegal wealth transfer from one nation to another in the history of mankind. Today, the Chinese Communist Party has more control over what Americans can say, what we can hear, what we can read, what we can watch, than any foreign government has ever had in our history. And they have weaponized our openness. They have weaponized our decency. And they have weaponized a corporate lust for profits against us. And if we don't wake up and we don't address this now, the America our children are going to inherit very soon could very well be one where the sanctimonious preachings, as someone once said, the sanctimonious preachings of a genocidal communist tyranny will be the only thing that Americans will be allowed to hear or say about China. So I'm glad we're having this hearing. And Mr. Chairman, just as a point of privilege here, one of our longtime staffers, today's his last hearing with us, Paul Matulik. He's been with the committee, he's been 16 years, worked with Senators Hatch and Chambliss and Burr and Cornyn and now here with us. And so he's retiring, and we hope, as all retirees should. He's moving to Florida. We don't know. But that's what Americans do. But anyway, we want to thank him for his service to the committee. We hope our last hearing will be a memorable one. So thank you for your service, sir.
Well. Let me echo that. And this was a subject of quite a bit of focus yesterday in our closed hearing, where he went into some of Paul's behavior and linguistic abilities. Luckily, that will stay classified. But we all very much value Paul's work, and again, want to commend him in particular for he and the whole team, but their relentless pursuit of the truth in the Russia investigation. With that, we turn to our witnesses, and I'm not sure, Anna, Bill, or Matt on WebEx, who's going to go first, but the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Chairman Warner, Vice Chairman Rubio, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here before you today. I've humbly briefed this committee on a regular basis for more than a decade as the Director of National Counterintelligence and Security Center and as a senior executive of the FBI and CIA. I was tremendously honored last year to be the first Senate-confirmed director of NCSC, leading our nation's counterintelligence efforts, and I must specifically thank this committee for your support. I'm here today before you as a private citizen. Today's topic, the holistic and comprehensive threat to the United States posed by the Communist Party of China, is an existential threat, and is the most complex, pernicious, aggressive, and strategic threat our nation has ever faced. I proffer that the U.S. private sector and academia have become the geopolitical battle space for China. Xi Jinping has one goal, to be the geopolitical, military, and economic leader in the world, period. He, along with China's Ministry of State Security, People's Liberation Army, and United Front Work Department, drive a comprehensive and whole-of-country approach to their efforts to invest, leverage, infiltrate, influence, and steal from every corner of the United States. This is a generational battle for Xi and the Communist Party. It drives their every decision. So why does it matter? Because economic security is national security. Our economic global supremacy, stability, and long-term vitality is at risk and squarely in the crosshairs of Xi Jinping and the Communist regime. It is estimated that 80% of American adults have had all of their personal data stolen by the Communist Party of China. The other 20%, just some of the data. As the chairman and vice chairman already referenced, the estimated economic loss last year from the country of China, just from known intellectual property and trade secret loss, is between $300 and $600 billion a year. It's a big number. What that means, it's between $4,000 and $6,000 per American family of four after taxes. Competition is great and necessary, and it is what made America the global leader we are today. However, I would proffer China's economic growth the past decade via any and all means is considerably less than fair competition. My question is, are we really competing? If we do not alter how we compete with awareness of China's malign methodology and one-sided practices, we will not sustain our global position as the world leaders from tomorrow's emerging technology down to our creative ideations. We must create a robust public-private partnership with real intelligence sharing, while at the same time staying true to the values, morals, and rule of law which made America the greatest country in the world. This will take a whole-of-nation approach with a mutual fund analogous long-term commitment. Such an approach must start with a contextual awareness campaign reaching a broad audience from every level of government to university campuses and from boardrooms to business schools. The why matters. As an example, Huawei is a national security threat to the United States. This committee is aware of that. But we do not effectively explain to America why. U.S. boards of directors and investment leaders must begin to look beyond next fiscal quarterly earnings call and begin to think strategically about how their investment decisions and unawareness of the long-term threat can impact their businesses and industries, as well as America's economic and national security. From a cybersecurity perspective, China possesses persistent and unending resources to penetrate our systems and exfiltrate our data, or sit dormant and wait, or plant malware on a critical infrastructure for future hostilities. At the same time, the insider threat epidemic originating from the Communist Party of China has been nothing short of devastating to the United States corporate world. Additionally, the Communist Party of China strategically conducts malign influence campaigns at the state and local level of the United States with precision. These efforts must be exposed and mitigated. To effectively defend against China and compete effectively, we must put the same effort into this threat as we did to combat terrorism in the past 20 years. I would suggest the threat posed by the Communist Party of China is much more dangerous to our economic and military viability as a nation. In conclusion, I would like to state for the record, as the chairman and vice chairman mentioned, the significant national security threat we face from the Communist Party of China is not a threat posed by the Chinese people or as individuals. Chinese nationals or any Chinese person or Chinese ethnicity here in the United States or around the world are not a threat and should not be racially targeted in any manner whatsoever. This is a threat pertaining to a draconian communist country with an autocratic dictator who is committed to human rights violations and stopping at nothing to achieve his geopolitical goals. Thank you for this opportunity to be here with you today, and I look forward to dialogue with my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Anna?
Thank you. Chairman Warner, Ranking Member Rubio, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The issues we are going to discuss will make us uncomfortable because they touch on the core beliefs and assumptions we make as Americans regarding democracy, opportunity, capitalism, open markets, and the importance and role of immigrants throughout the history of the U.S. My own grandparents were immigrants who came here to this country with little formal education, worked menial jobs, and made a new life for themselves. My presence here today is a testament to the American dream. I want to start with saying that there's no room for xenophobia or ethnic profiling in the U.S. It goes against everything we have stood for as a nation. And precisely because of these values, we need to find a principled way forward. The issues should not be seen as concerns of one administration or the policies of one political party, but as the challenges created by a nation state that is ever more authoritarian and that has a different system, a different regard for human rights, and a different view of competition and fairness. Since you have my written testimony, I will focus my remarks on some of the highlights. China is engaged in a strategic rivalry with the U.S., centered on economic power. China's management of its relationship with the U.S. has been designed to mask key aspects of this rivalry. This is why it's so difficult to have these conversations. Beijing, in many ways, understands the societal tensions, and its statecraft is directed at them, exploiting identity politics and promoting any changes to U.S. policy as ethnic profiling. Extreme positions, such as closing our eyes or closing the doors, only benefits China. So now let's take a moment and talk about what's at stake. United States science and technology dominance since World War II has underpinned U.S. national strength and soft power. Losing our technological edge and the influence it entails will have far-reaching implications beyond scientific disciplines. This is not only about military technologies. Future strength will be built on 5G, AI, and biotechnology. And our systems are fundamentally not the same. China's central government policies and the role of the state create this different system. These include talent programs that exploit its diaspora, S&T development programs with acquisition strategies built into them, and China's policy on civil-military fusion. Let me be clear. China says it will use any knowledge or technology it acquires for its military. This is not conjecture or profiling or analysis, but China's stated position, and I would add for decades. We should believe them. Given the scope and scale of China's activities, a reevaluation of our underlying assumptions and how we evaluate risk will be essential to counter these efforts. Therefore, I have the following recommendations. First, we really do need to improve ourselves. The U.S. and other liberal democracies must invest in the future. And we also have to realize that not all discovery has immediate commercial application. We need to focus on things that provide the highest value to the nation instead of just the lowest cost. We must build research security into future funding programs. We also need to face the facts as a society. Beijing doesn't play by fair market rules. It does not respect foreign intellectual property. It is willing to act directly and indirectly to ensure its favored companies win in the market. The result of this is that our companies and our researchers are not competing on an equal and level playing field, but instead are up against the strategy, and I would add the power and the money, of a nation state. We must increase transparency. Existing policies and laws are insufficient to address the level of influence the Chinese Communist Party exerts in our society, especially in academia. We must increase reporting requirements for foreign money at our academic and research institutes, and university government labs and research institutions should have clear reporting requirements and rules on the participation of foreign talent programs. And that part really needs to be country agnostic. We need to ensure true reciprocity. This is about fairness and market access. We can no longer allow China to weaponize its market. Connecting China's reciprocity and sharing of scientific data to its access to U.S. institutions and big science facilities is a leverage point. For too long, we have looked the other way when China has not followed through on the details of its agreements that it has entered into. We also need to bolster cooperation and the communication of risk with our allies and partners. What also makes these conversations difficult, and as my colleague has alluded to, is that the reality that China is presenting is inconvenient to those that are benefiting in the short term. This includes companies looking for short-term profits, academics that benefit personally from funding and cheap labor in their laboratories, and former government officials who cash in as lobbyists for China, state-owned and state-supported companies. We need to move beyond tactical solutions and have a comprehensive strategy for how we deal with China. So I would like to thank the committee once again for continuing to discuss this issue. These are hard conversations that we as a nation must have if we are going to protect and promote U.S. competitiveness, future developments, and our values. If we do not highlight and address China's policies that violate global norms and our values, we give credence to a system that undermines fairness, openness, and human rights. The Chinese people deserve better, the U.S. people deserve better, and I think our future really depends on it. So thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. And now I think we're going to hear from WebEx. On WebEx, Matt Pottinger.
Great. Thumbs up if you can hear me.
We can hear you, but not see you. Oh, there you are. Now we can do both.
Great. Well, Chairman Warner and Vice Chairman Rubio, thank you and your fellow committee members for hosting a public hearing on this very important topic. Many Americans were slow to realize it, but Beijing's enmity for the United States really began decades ago. Ever since the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP, came into power in 1949, it's cast the United States as an antagonist. And then 3 decades ago, at the end of the Cold War, Beijing quietly revised its grand strategy to regard Washington as its primary external adversary, and it embarked on a quest for regional followed by global dominance. So the United States and other free societies have belatedly woken up to this contest, and there's a welcome spirit of bipartisanship that's emerged on Capitol Hill. But even with this new consensus, we failed to adequately appreciate, I think, one of the most threatening elements of Chinese strategy, and that's the way that it seeks to influence and coerce Americans, including political, business, and scientific leaders, in the service of Beijing's ambitions. So the CCP's methods are really a manifestation of political warfare, which is the term that George Kennan, the chief architect of our Cold War strategy of containment, used in a 1948 memo to describe the employment of all of the means at a nation's command, short of war, to achieve its national objectives. So that's what China's doing. And one of the most crucial elements of Beijing's political warfare is its so-called United Front work. So United Front work is an immense range of activities with no analog in democracies. China's leaders call it a magic weapon, and the CCP's 95 million members are all required to participate in the system, which has many different branches. The United Front Work Department alone, which is just one branch, has 3 times as many cadres as the U.S. State Department has foreign service officers, except instead of practicing diplomacy, the United Front gathers intelligence about and works to influence private citizens, as well as government officials overseas, with a focus on foreign elites and the organizations they run, including businesses that you and Senator Rubio just mentioned. Peter Mattis, who detailed how United Front work is organized during his 2019 testimony before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, said, put simply, United Front work is conducted wherever the party is present. And the party is quite present here in the United States. So assembling dossiers on people has always been a feature of Leninist regimes. But Beijing's penetration of digital networks worldwide, including using 5G networks that you referenced, Chairman Warner, has really taken this to a new level. So the party now compiles dossiers on millions of foreign citizens around the world, using the material that it gathers to influence and target and intimidate, reward, blackmail, flatter, and humiliate, and ultimately divide and conquer. So Bill Evanina's written testimony today makes plain that Beijing has stolen sensitive data sufficient to build a dossier on every single American adult and on many of our children, too, who are fair game under Beijing's rules of political warfare. So newer to the Communist Party's arsenal is the exploitation of U.S. social media platforms. So over the past few years, Beijing has flooded U.S. platforms with overt and covert propaganda, amplified by proxies and bots. And the propaganda is focused not only on promoting whitewashed narratives of Beijing's policies, but also increasingly on exacerbating social tensions within the United States and other target nations. The Chinese government and its online proxies, for example, have for months promoted content that questions the effectiveness and safety of our Western-made COVID-19 vaccines. There's been some recent research by the Sufan Center that also found indications that China-based influence operations online are now outpacing Russian efforts to amplify some conspiracy theories. So what are some of the things that Washington can do to address Beijing's political warfare? First, I think we should stop funding technologies in China that are used to advance the surveillance state and the military of Beijing. So Beijing's turning facial recognition, 5G, data mining, machine learning technologies, and others, not only against their own citizens, but increasingly against Americans here at home. So the executive orders that were issued by the Trump and Biden administrations that prohibit the U.S. purchase of stocks and bonds in 59 named Chinese companies is a good start. But the Treasury Department really needs to expand that list by orders of magnitude in order to better encompass the galaxy of Chinese companies that are developing these so-called dual-use technologies. Congress should also look at revising the Foreign Agent Registration Act, or FARA, to include more robust reporting requirements, steeper penalties for noncompliance, and a publicly accessible database of FARA registrants and their activities that's updated regularly. The United States can also do more to expose and confront Beijing's information warfare through our social media platforms. Remember, these are platforms that are themselves banned inside of China's own borders. So U.S. social media companies have the technological know-how and resources to take a leading role in exposing and tamping down shadowy influence operations online. And the U.S. government should partner more closely with Silicon Valley companies in this work. Washington should also partner with U.S. technology giants to make it easier for the Chinese people to safely access and exchange news, opinions, history, films, and satire with their fellow citizens and other people who are outside of China's Great Firewall. Finally, we should do more to protect Chinese students and other Chinese nationals living here in the United States. Many people of Chinese descent, including some U.S. permanent residents and even U.S. citizens, live in fear that their family members back in China will be detained or otherwise punished for what their American relatives say or do here in the United States. And this kind of coercion by Beijing, among other things, has silenced countless Chinese language news outlets around the world. So much so that there's almost no private Chinese language news outlet left in the United States or abroad that doesn't toe the Communist Party line. The U.S. government can help by offering grants to promising private outlets and also re-energizing some of the federally funded media such as Radio Free Asia. And U.S. universities, maybe with help from the U.S. government, should also hand a second smartphone to every Chinese national who comes to study in our schools in the United States, so that they have a smartphone that is free from Chinese apps such as WeChat, which monitor users' activities and censor their news feeds. Thanks very much.
Well, again, I want to thank all three of the our witnesses today, and again for late arriving members. We're going to go by traditional seniority in 5-minute rounds. I also very much appreciate all three of you making the point that our beef is with the CCP and its leadership, and not the Chinese people, and surely not the Chinese diaspora, Chinese Americans, and that there is no place for racist or xenophobic targeting in our country, and that in many ways would simply play into the hands of the CCP. Let me start. I was going to start with a question different than I was originally going to start with, which is something that we're current taking place. As we know, or maybe I'm not sure most Americans know, that in roughly 2015, 2016, China changed its, in a sense, corporate legal framework to make explicitly clear that any Chinese company's first obligation was not to its shareholders or even its employees, but its first obligation was to the Communist Party. Coincident with that same time, we have seen an emergence, oftentimes driven, as Bill pointed out, by intellectual property theft. We've seen an emergence of Chinese, particularly social media, delivery, other companies that have had some of the biggest returns of any companies in the world over the last few years, the Alibabas, the Baidus, the Tencents. What I'm not sure most folks have realized is that those companies and many others, the vast majority of their investors are either American or Westerners. Something unique has happened, though, in the starting with Jack Ma and Ant when they tried to go public. Number of months back, and the government intervened and stopped that enterprise from going public. A number of other companies have now been cracked, Chinese tech companies have now been cracked down upon. Is this an ability to try to get their large tech companies under control the same way we're having that active debate in this country? Is it, in a sense, a warning shot across the bow for those companies that have potentially been trying to go public either here in the United States or on the Hong Kong exchange as opposed to inside the PRC? Or is it even a possibility that this is an effort, since these companies are not going away, to wash out those Western and American investors? Because we've seen the values of these companies in some cases decrease by 50% literally over the last 60 to 90 days. And then to have them, in a sense, refinanced with a Chinese funds themselves with more compliant tech leadership. And I throw that out to all three of the members of the panel for comments.
Senator, I thank you very much for that question and those points. You know, I think you're exactly right that what you're seeing now is a deliberate obliteration of the line, certainly a blurring, but ultimately an obliteration of the line between private companies on the one hand and state-owned companies on the other in China, an obliteration of the line separating civilian companies on the one hand and military companies and institutions on the other, and even a blurring of the line between foreign invested companies, multinational companies, so to speak, and domestic Chinese state champions. Beijing's goal is to reconcentrate the authority of the party over all of the economic life of Beijing. And that's really what this is about, much more than just wanting to assert control over data, although that's one of the other reasons that Beijing has been taking these steps against Alibaba and Didi and many, many others to come. There are a number of laws that force those functions that you reference, and I'd be happy to provide an index of some of those laws that require companies in China, including foreign joint ventures, to first and foremost serve the national security interests of the party, to serve the party's broader interests, and to work at the behest of the security apparatus to do that. So corporate governance in China is not what is represented in public filings to, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission. I've been waiting, turning purple, holding my breath, waiting for the Securities and Exchange Commission to begin asserting its authority to actually recognize that the risk factors are not even remotely adequately addressed in the public filings of Chinese companies here in the United States.
Matt, could I cut you off there? Because I want to make sure I'm going to try to adhere to my time, and I want to see if Anna or Bill have another comment on this topic as well.
Sir, Senator, just two foot stomps from your point, and to maybe amplify what Matt had mentioned. For specifically for corporate America, the three laws that China initiated, two national security laws and one cyber law, I think are critical for CEOs and investment folks in the United States to understand. Most importantly is from a technological perspective that every CISO and CIO in China, for a Chinese company, in China or abroad, is mandated to provide third-party data to the intelligence organizations in China. So if you are a U.S. company and you're partnering with a company in China, you have to be aware that all your data will be provided to the intelligence services in China. That's number one. Secondly, to your point, 13 of the 15 largest companies in China are state-owned or operated. There's only two left. Alibaba is one of the two left, and we see what's happened to them now overseas in China with the draconian efforts that Xi is employing.
So I just want to foot stomp on the laws, and that's something that we can provide to the committee. But in some ways, you know, to take a lighter attempt, this is, they've actually said the quiet part out loud in seeing what's happening to these companies, because this actually is a really good demonstration of how different the systems are.
I would point out, and before I move to the vice chairman, we had 13 of what we call our classified roadshows. Every industry, virtually every major college and university in America, participated in one or more of those, with the exception of private equity. The very private equity that funded some of these Chinese tech companies that are now getting absolutely creamed as the Chinese government reasserts control. Maybe they would have been better to take advantage of our repeated offers to meet with private equity in a classified setting so they understood perhaps better what they were getting themselves into. So I'm not shedding a lot of tears for some of their losses, but I do hope on a going forward basis they and others will continue to make sure that they go in with eyes wide open in terms of dealing with the PRC. With that, Senator Rubio.
Thank you. Mr. Pottinger, let me start with you. Did China try to manipulate public opinion in the United States and around the world during the early days of the COVID pandemic?
Senator Rubio, certainly we saw all sorts of activity by Beijing, overt propaganda as well as what I would call more shadowy schemes to influence and amplify messages that in many cases are disguised to appear as though they are organic discourse between private citizens, but are really very carefully and well-resourced campaigns, orchestrated by Chinese propaganda officials. Now, some of you're referencing the time early in the COVID epidemic. Some of the ones I can just think of off the top of my head were efforts to create doubt about the origins of this pandemic, and in fact, to claim that that the pandemic originated from the U.S. military. We saw efforts to undermine, as I mentioned earlier, the credibility of our vaccines. Certainly, quite a lot of propaganda, both overt and covert, designed to create distrust and a lack of faith in democracy as a whole, and to amp up and elevate the idea of Leninist totalitarianism as a somehow superior model, in spite of what the record has been over the decades that the Chinese Communist Party has been in power. I'm thinking of the tens of millions of deaths of its own citizens from mismanagement from their government. So the short answer is yes, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Puglisi, the National Counterintelligence and Security Center warned, I think in February, that China's collecting the medical data, the DNA, and the genomic data of Americans. Why do they want the DNA and genomic information of Americans?
So China has amassed the largest genomic holdings of anywhere in the world. One of the most important questions in the next generation of both medicine and also biological research is the genotype to phenotype. So understanding what genes do. And so access to that kind of data, both their own and from other places in the world, gives them an advantage in figuring out some of those problems. And we know from their central government policies and programs, they have emphasized the importance of next generation medicine, and that is a huge focus for them.
Meaning the designing of precision medicine that allows curing specific conditions in people with specific genetic makeups.
Yes.
Mr. Avenina, how, in your opinion, how confident is China in their ability to get American banks, American investment firms, and American big business, how confident are they in their ability to get these to act as their lobbyists here in Washington?
Senator Rubio, there's no lack of confidence. I don't believe the Communist Party of China has any reticence to believe they can't acquire whatever they want to acquire. And you see currently now with the new movement of the Communist Party of China investing into pension funds, both at the state and local level, as well as into our thrift savings plan federally. They do it in a sublime manner, sometimes shrouded in U.S. business investment and shrouded with third-party fund companies to be able to get and garner their corner, their market, so to speak, in our investment funds. So they have no lack of confidence in acquiring anything they need in our financial services sector.
No, and that's for sure. But I think the question was, how confident are they in their ability to get an American company, for example, or a finance sector or what have you, to use the lure of access to the Chinese marketplace to get them to come back to Washington and lobby policymakers here against or for decisions that China favors? In essence, they deputize them to come back and say, don't do this or don't do that. Their ability to turn these American entities into lobbyists for their preferred policy outcome in our policies.
Again, there's no lack of confidence, and we've seen that occur in other parts of Chinese lobbying here in D.C., hiring former members of Congress, former members of the administration, former members of large banks to be able to come back and lobby and explain China's methodology and their narrative as to why their funding is more important than any funding here. And I will reiterate Senator Warner's point that some of my activities subsequent to retirement, the private equity and venture capital folks are saying they're getting 30% ROI from investments in China.
Yeah, and so just real quick tied to that, are they forward-thinking enough to look at a state legislator, a mayor, a commissioner at the local level and say that person may one day be a member of Congress, let's start working them now, get close to them, and have them adopt our favored narrative of China so that in the future, when they wind up in that position, they'll be more favorable to our views?
Absolutely, and it's a common practice.
I would point out that I want to note that Senator Cornyn and Senator Feinstein did some very good work that all of us on the committee supported on trying to strengthen some of those restrictions on that foreign investment with the CFIUS Act. Senator White.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank to all our panelists. I'm of the view that data is one of the most underappreciated threats to America's national security. And that is especially true when you're talking about Americans' data being exported to our adversaries. And it's already the case that the Chinese government or hackers based in China have stolen the personal information of hundreds of millions of Americans. As a result, I have been pushing hard to enact a law that would ensure that Americans' most private data cannot be sold off in bulk to countries that it would use it against us. So my question to you is, I want to pick up on one of the earlier questions one of my colleagues just asked about with respect to genetic data, And because of the importance of this issue, Mr. Ivanina, I know you've spent a lot of time on this. How does the Chinese government actually obtain the genetic information of Americans? And tell us, for the record, why that's so dangerous to national security.
Thank you, Senator Wyden. I think there's a couple aspects to this question. First is to footstomp your message of China's demand for data. When we look at what they've accumulated in the last decade, I'll point to Equifax. 150 million Americans, all their financial data has been taken by China. I will say that it's unnecessary for China to procure or buy our data when they can come in and take it for free. Because of our lack of cybersecurity defenses here, provide an open door for them to take through spear phishing other vectors to get into our systems and take our data. With respect to DNA and genomics, they'll use front companies like BGI, which is a company around the world, to set up stations to collect COVID samples and do fertility clinics. And every single time you do that, you're giving away all your data to that owner of that company, which, as we said before, is now beholden to the Communist Party. So as you provide genetics, blood typing, or any kind of COVID test, it's going to possibly go to the Chinese Communist Party, which is why we must protect what we do here on our soil from companies like Quest and other diagnostic companies, which are in every single town, from being procured by the Chinese government.
I'm going to also hold the record open, because I feel so strongly about this, for any additional information you could give us on exactly how they obtain the genetic information, because that's the threshold question. You know, when American companies are being purchased, there's the CFIUS process that addresses the purchase of American companies. But the purchasing and export of the data itself is totally unregulated, which is why I feel so strongly about this legislation. And so if, Mr. Ivanina, in the next week or so, you could give us more information on how they actually go about doing it. Question for you, Ms. Puglisi. It's clear that the American government has been forcing the transfer of a number of valuable American innovations through legal acquisitions and illicit tactics. Another legislative initiative I'm pushing would require companies doing business in China to report on technology and IP transfers. In your view, wouldn't this requirement help the U.S. government get a better sense of the problem and allow for our government, as we try to put together an all-of-government response, come up with a better approach?
So I think that really gets at that transparency issue and understanding. I think to step back from that as well, what's important is understanding what are the market conditions that are being set. Because we know that China has used its market to force technology transfer. And so having a better understanding of, and also pushing back on that, will help both with that transparency piece and understanding the pressures that those U.S. companies are under.
I'm over my time. I'm going to give you all a written question on hacking, which is sort of the other side of the coin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Wyden. Senator Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Anna, I found your opening statement to be very clear and very diplomatic, I will say. I'm going to read you a statement that I think encompasses the threat. You tell me what I've left out of it, if you will. The People's Republic of China is actively conducting multidiscipline espionage operations against the United States. Further, the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in influence and intelligence operations inside the United States at an unprecedented scale, targeting numerous sectors of society, including the academic community, private sector, media platforms, and policymakers in order to advance its security and economic objectives and strengthen the CCP's hold on power. The CCP aims to acquire technology, conduct espionage, and shape narratives to align the CCP's ideology and objectives. Is there anything you disagree in that statement? Is there anything I've left out?
The one thing I would like to highlight is that one of the challenges in dealing with how China targets our technology is they use a very different methodology. So if we focus only on intelligence officers, things that have a military direct military application and things that are illegal, I believe we will fail. And so it's looking at those gray areas and looking at how legitimate, what start as legitimate cooperations or collaborations or even business deals get moved into that gray area.
Well, I think we would agree with you, Bill. The Department of Justice has used the name and shame program, the model of highlighting cases of Chinese espionage in the United States, and it currently makes the public more aware of CCP's nefarious activities within the U.S. In your opinion, how effective is name and shame, and what, if anything else, can be done to deter the Chinese?
Senator, I'm a big believer in the efficacy of name and shame. I think that when you look at Xi Jinping and his regime, what hurts him the most is any kind of negative consequence. And as we get the word out, not only around the globe, and as you know, in my previous role, I was head of counterintelligence for NATO. When I would speak to our NATO partners, they would be excited because of the naming and shaming and the exploitation of criminal behavior by the Chinese communist regime. You have big cases, whether it be Huawei or any other kind of espionage investigation, insiders or cyber, that gets known around Europe and around South Asia and about South America. So it allows U.S. government, policymakers, intelligence services to garner support and build coalitions against China, whether it be Belt and Road or their economic proclivity in Europe. And I would proffer that the work the U.S. government has done on Huawei and calling out their nefarious behaviors has done a whirlwind of efforts in Europe with the EU and NATO.
Good. Matt Pottinger, what technologies do you believe we must do a better job at protecting, and sort of what's after 5G?
Thank you, Senator. I think that we know from China's own strategy and from the actions in implementing that strategy that they view semiconductor mastery, that is the all of the elements, including the fabrication of semiconductors, as the foundational technology upon which everything else that we're competing against China for in this century is resting on. So whether we're talking about synthetic biology or 6G, 7G, advanced materials and machine learning, all of this is built on advanced semiconductors, and Beijing is quite determined to make itself wholly independent of any other market for those semiconductors, and in ways that would also make us increasingly dependent on China so that they would have enormous coercive leverage over us. So I'm a free market guy. There's the one exception that I'm really making is that I believe that we do need to provide subsidies to bring back a certain amount of the manufacturing of semiconductors in the United States to remove that piece of leverage from China. So semiconductors is number one. In the area of 5G and the other generations of wireless and communications technology that are going to follow, we need to use our export controls more sharply than I think we've been using to date. We did some very important things in 2020, expanding the foreign direct product rule, making it impossible essentially for heavily state-owned and state-subsidized companies like Huawei to obtain high-end semiconductors. We need to use those tools even more sharply now before we lose them. Again, we've got some companies in the United States that make great equipment for making semiconductors, and they want to access the China market. In the long run, that's going to be very bad for us if we're giving China the means to create a coercive and wholly independent manufacturing capability. We want to bring some of that home, forego some of those short-term smaller profits now in order to grow a much larger pie after that.
Thank you. And I just want to clear up one item, Bill. I think in your response to Senator Wyden, I believe your point was that we have to be careful about the Chinese, for example, acquiring certain American labs or other items. It's not the fact that if you get a COVID test right now, that data goes to China. So just to be clear for the record. Senator Heinrich.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Puglisi, I apologize. I want to yield a little time to Senator King, who has a pressing.
I have a meeting that I have to go to, but I'll be submitting four questions for the record, and I hope you all will provide some of your good thinking on it. These are sort of thought questions based upon today's testimony. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You bet. You co-authored a recent report entitled China's Foreign Technology Wish List, which looks at how China's science and tech diplomats working out of embassies and consulates across the world act as brokers to acquire foreign technology. And the report notes that artificial intelligence, machine learning are sort of near the top of that wish list. Can you discuss the role that these science and tech diplomats play in acquiring foreign technology? And what else are you seeing in the areas of AI and machine learning in particular?
Of course. So so I think what the role of S&T diplomats, what it really highlights is the depth and breadth of China's tech acquisition bureaucracy. As we lay it out in this report, and this is based on Chinese language documents that we have mined and acquired, so it's all open source material, that there's a demand signal, and so the entity in China requests or highlights that they have a gap, either in technology or knowledge, that goes to a central database, and then it's actually farmed out across the world. And what's interesting about this is it really shows a nuanced understanding of where that technology is located and where to find that. And as you mentioned, the two things, the highest that showed up the most in our research was both AI, machine learning, and actually biotechnology. And one of the hub of activity for that in the United States was the Houston consulate.
Very interesting. The CCP has leveraged individuals outside of government to pursue technology transfer, targeting foreign researchers and business leaders in order to transfer that technology back to the PRC. Can you walk us through any examples that are particularly illustrative, either in academia or in the private sector, just to give folks a sense for like how this tactic really plays out in real life?
So what I'll speak to is a specific methodology that we see. Is that better? Okay, sorry about that. So what is interesting in both as in my previous iteration working for him, we always get questions about, okay, what is the list, right? What is the technologies that are being sought? And we do have that in a very general sense. But what makes that so challenging is what we call China's use of non-traditional collectors. And so these are actually the experts that are working on a particular area, working on a particular project, that are the ones that are targeting the technologies. What makes it so hard to counter a lot of times is initially some of these relationships begin as legitimate, whether they be collaborations or individuals that either join universities or join companies. But China has a number of policies, and one of the ones that I think pertains to this particular type of targeting of technology is one called serve in place. And it's something that we've seen reflected in Chinese policy documents since the early 90s. And it articulates that they seek to leverage individuals who have who are not living in China, who don't have any intention to go back, and they reach out to those people to fill strategic gaps. And increasingly, even more so, is the technological know-how. And so the how do you do things, how do you do quality control, how do you move technology out of the lab?
Wow. Mr. Pottinger, could you talk a little bit more about semiconductor manufacturing and fabrication, and how would you rate our efforts so far at trying to start the process of bringing that back to domestic production, and what additional efforts would you recommend?
Thanks, Senator. So the majority of the world's highest-end chips are actually made in Taiwan by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. China makes has put well over $100 billion in subsidies into trying to replicate what Taiwan's able to do, and with very mixed results. In fact, they've not been able to replicate what Taiwan does, but what they are now trying to do, having recognized the fact they can't make chips at the bleeding cutting edge the way that Taiwan makes them, China's trying to make chips that are a couple of generations older than the chips that Taiwan makes. Now, older does not mean worse, because in fact, you know, the device I'm talking to you on right now, you know, or a personal smartphone is made up of, you know, 10 chips, maybe only one of which is the really cutting edge chip. The others, which control graphics and voice and cameras and things of that nature, are older technology chips, which make up a massive segment of the market. They're still extremely important, and they can be leveraged in ways to make them greater than the sum of their parts, depending on how creatively you tie these things together. So we do in the United States, we don't make that many chips anymore. We have a couple of exceptions. There's a company called Global Foundries in upstate New York that makes chips that are a couple of generations older. But it turns out that our military, most of our equipment runs on chips that are a couple of generations or more older, because those systems stay in place for so long. So it's been critical that we have a certain amount of manufacturing here at home. We also, where we really lead is in the design of chips, and also in equipment that's used in the fabrication of the chips. So those are areas where we want to do a better job, more strategic job of looking holistically at how we can deny China its very deliberate and clear objective of making itself completely independent and making us increasingly dependent on their supply for semiconductors, which until we have another technology are absolutely essential to every area where we want to compete in the innovative economy.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Blunt.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Politsky, nothing, let's talk about campuses for a minute. Nothing creates more friends for the United States of America than time in the United States of America. And this research discussion is one discussion. Another discussion is there are lots of Chinese students on campuses that have fine business schools, that have good health programs of various kinds, and other programs that don't do a lot of research. What are the dangers of us closing the door to smart, young Chinese people who want to come here and spend a couple of years? And how do we thread that needle?
Senator, that's a really important point. And it's really important to make that distinguish between undergraduates, graduate students that are studying things that we're concerned with. And I think it circles back to the remarks that I made about acknowledging how different our systems are, because we can't possibly understand. I think my colleagues also spoke to this, the amount of pressure that some of those students can be under if their families are still in China. The most recent Global Human Rights Watch report that came out talks about surveillance happening on U.S. campuses of these Chinese students.
Well, I think we have to be careful there, because just like we can't understand the pressure they're under, they can't understand what the United States is like in the same way as if they were here. And, you know, Chinese students, particularly undergraduate students in a non-research setting on campus, I think that's a different thing than people, technical research, calling back the results to the mock lab in China somewhere. I think we need to be really careful about this, because I think I'm going to go to Mr. Pottinger next. It seems to me that there is a likely change in a mindset here. You know, we all know that China has a huge demographics problem, and I don't want to go down the demographics trail. The trail I want to go down is there are millions of young Chinese adults who in their whole life they've had two parents who were totally focused on them and four grandparents who had one grandchild also totally focused on them in a country
that had more things to share, more ways to buy things for that one grandchild, are they going to have the same response to the increasingly repressive Chinese Communist Party that the generation before have had? Are we seeing some likely pushback from young Chinese adults who've had basically all the attention you could possibly ask for their entire life and almost everything they wanted to have from parents and grandparents?
Yeah, Senator, there's been recent reporting, some interesting reports have been written about sort of this ennui that is afflicting the younger generation of Chinese young men and women. I think that that the Communist Party has systematically removed from Chinese culture so many of the elements that could enrich people's lives, including, you know, faith, including what had been in the late 90s into the early 2000s, a growing amount of free exchange and discourse. Those things are now going in reverse. You're seeing the systematic stamping out of civic life, whether it's secular or religious. The most extreme example is the genocide taking place against traditionally ethnic Muslim minorities in Northwest China, but also against Christians and others. And access to outside information is getting more restrictive.
Thank you. Let me see if I get one quick question. So Billy Maniva, what of this increasing more restricted society, how is that, in all the ways you've looked at that, how is that coming generation going to react to that in a different way than their parents and grandparents have?
Senator, thanks for the question. I think your premise is correct. We are seeing that kind of slow change, but I would proffer that Xi Jinping is seeing that same change as well, and he's becoming more draconian. They've become the most impressive surveillance state in the history of the world, not only domestically in China, but as well as we heard here in the U.S. Those 320,000 students who come into the U.S. are forced to have Chinese phones with WeChat so the Chinese can monitor them here. So when you are here, whether you're a student or a researcher, and you get a call from the Ministry of State Security asking you to do something for them, and your grandmother is sick or your father needs a job, you are going to do whatever they ask you to do. So as much as we see a change in the want of the Chinese young people to get internet, the quicker we see that, the quicker the Chinese Communist Party disallows them to have the internet.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, I want to first start by thanking you for not just holding this hearing, but for the focus of the Intelligence Committee's attention on this subject for quite a while. I've been on the committee now for 3 years, and what I'm about to say, I didn't know before I had the benefit of the hearings that we have had, and that is that the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government, will use any means, licit or illicit, to pursue their China First policy. And the question for us is whether we're willing or whether we're going to be collateral damage and all of that. And this isn't just a fight or a competition, let's use that language, a competition between two economies. It's a competition between democracy on the one hand and totalitarianism on the other. It doesn't have anything to do, as you said, with the decisions the Chinese people are making, but they are the decisions that the Chinese government has made and increasingly in the last decade exported around the world. So we're facing the consequences of that all over the world. That creates a huge and heavy burden for us and for our democracy, I think, and calls into question some of the idiotic battles we've had around this place instead of being focused, our attention where it ought to be focused, calls into question whether or not we've done enough to work with our allies and other democracies around the world and other economies around the world who share similar equities to ours with respect to China, which the good news is almost every other economy and every other democracy in the world, not everyone, but almost everyone, shares those equities. And that's why, in the end, I'm optimistic. I think we can compete because I think we've got a much better system than they have. when it's working properly and when it's working well. So I actually, in all of that, have a question. Maybe I'll start with Mr. Pottinger just because he's not here, and then anybody else who would want to answer it. If you disagree with anything I said, please feel free to do that. This is America. You can do that. We'd be happy to have it. But if you don't, I'd be curious what message you would like to send, to go back to the chairman's initial question, to private equity firms in the United States, to their leadership, the leadership of venture capital firms and other investment firms that are investing in Chinese technology, imagining that somehow it's not dual-use technology, imagining that somehow the Communist Party isn't going to be the beneficiary of this, and telling themselves that that ROI that Bill talked about somehow is worth whatever the risks are. So why don't we start, Mr. Pottinger, with you.
Thanks, Senator. I think that the argument on returns on investment is rapidly evaporating. We saw the obliteration of close to $1 trillion in shareholder value just in the last several weeks, as Chinese stocks were systematically rectified by regulators in Beijing. And so that argument, I think, over time is going to atrophy. But what I would tell, you know, private equity investors, including venture capital investors, is that ultimately many of the technologies that they're investing in fact, arguably almost every successful Chinese tech company that exists today was seeded with Silicon Valley or other foreign venture capital money, as well as with Silicon Valley know-how. And we know that some of those companies have now applied their technology to some of the most nefarious human rights atrocities since the mid-20th century. So that is going to come back to haunt companies in reputationally, in ways that I think a lot of companies aren't yet prepared for.
Is there any, I've got 40 seconds left. I don't know if either of you would like to consume that.
I would just like to amplify Matt's message. And with the biggest, I would say the most painful salt in the wound is when American investors invest in tech companies in China, where that technology was stolen from the U.S. in the first place. And then we are forced to buy that technology as consumers at the end of the day. So our fruits of our thoughts and our ideations and our technology stolen, when they were forced to purchase it back from the Communist Party of China, is the painful salt in the wound.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cornyn.
Well, in typical Washington fashion, let me start out with some acronyms. CFIUS, FIRMA, ECRA, and FARA. I want to ask two questions about those topics. One is, in 2018, we did export control reforms. We reformed the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States and gave Treasury Department, which convenes that the CFIUS, a lot more resources. And I'd like to get your analysis of what's changed and what needs to change, what hasn't changed. And then on FARA, we've done a lot of work, I know, particularly in the Judiciary Committee, Senator Feinstein and Senator Grassley and me, trying to get reforms of the Foreign Agent Registration Act. The lobbying disclosure statement is a Lobbyist Disclosure Act, I think it's called, provides an out for foreign agents to register as lobbyists, but not as foreign agents, and basically impeding the benefit of our knowing who's a foreign agent and who's not. I think this is one of the biggest untold problems that we have dealing with foreign countries, including China, is we know other countries hire lobbyists and other agents, but if we don't know who they are and what their agenda is, it's pretty hard for us to put that in the proper context or protect ourselves. You know, we're supposed to represent our constituents and Americans, not the interests of foreign countries. And but if we don't know what the who's who, it's a real problem. So I might ask the three of you if you have something you could tell us about the CFIUS and FIRMA and export controls, and if you feel like we are where we need to be, if we there's more we need to do. And then I think I heard Mr. Pottinger talk about FARA when I, as I was walking in, but I would invite any one of the three of you to talk about that issue as well. So maybe, Mr. Evanina, can we start with you?
Thank you, Senator, and great question. And all three, CFIUS, FARA, and FIRMA, are very important aspects of how the government deals with this epidemic. I do think that subsequent to legislation and a few years ago, I think we still need to appropriate more resources to it. I think, yes, it was housed in Treasury, but there are a multitude of other agencies who could add value to that, who did not increase resources to that effort. So I do think it's the right vehicle. There's not enough people in that vehicle to do that work. So I'll caution with that. Secondarily, I think the premise of some of these is a little skewed because, as Anna talked about, the non-traditional collectors who come here, either wittingly or unwittingly working for the Communist Party of China, don't know they're lobbyists and don't know they're here registering as a foreign agent. Most likely they're not. And oftentimes they can conduct high-level research at a ceramics lab or an institute and then get a phone call one day by someone back home. They don't know that they're an agent of a foreign power and they don't know that they're a lobbyist. So I think sometimes the nomenclature and lexicon needs to be shaped and formatted more towards the non-traditional collector.
Ms. Puglisi, would you care to comment?
Sure. So it's encouraging, and all of the hard work that everyone on the committee has done, especially in these different areas. I think going forward, going back to my remarks, I think it's important to remember the multifaceted ways that China targets our technology and how different the systems are. I think one of the challenges, as we break this problem down into specific slices, we as a country, because we are a laws-based society, because we are a rules-based society, try to get things narrow to a specific point. But when we're dealing with a non-rules-based adversary or entity, it makes those policies much more difficult to not only enforce, but to have the desired outcome. And so I think as we move forward, we need to think about what is the desired outcome of the efforts across the board with technology acquisition, and how do we mitigate some of these activities and design policies and programs in addition to the ones that we already have that get at how do you deal with a non-rules-based entity.
Mr. Pottinger, would you care to comment?
Senator, thanks for your leadership on FIRMA a few years back, which was a real improvement on CFIUS. I would say that where there's still a loophole is in the area of venture capital and private equity. Beijing benefits enormously just from having a seat on those funds. It gives it a sort of a panopticon to see all of the newly emergent companies and technologies that they want to then target for more in-depth scrutiny and investment and theft. I think it's on the FARA front, you know, making a searchable public database that's frequently updated so that it becomes much more public and much more comprehensive, all of that activity that you're referring to, some of which is not currently captured, but which needs to be. Thank you.
Senator Casey.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for having this hearing and focusing our attention on these issues in this open setting. I wanted to start by making reference to Mr. Evanini's background. He's a Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania native, a Valley View High School graduate, also a degree from Wilkes University. So I just hope after your career is over that you at least retire in Lackawanna County. But we're grateful for your public service and for the work you continue to do. I will probably direct my what I hope would be two questions to Ms. Puglisi and Mr. Pottinger, but Bill, feel free to weigh in as well. I wanted to start with an issue that Senator Cornyn and I worked on, especially in the lead up to the most recent competition legislation. We introduced a bill called the National Critical Capabilities Defense Act. It would establish an interagency committee to review outbound transactions,
not inbound, but outbound, by U.S. firms to non-market economies like China that would, in my judgment and the judgment of a lot of people, result in the outsourcing of critical supply chains and create further U.S. dependence upon a non-market economy like China. I guess my first question is, to what extent is that kind of outbound investment by U.S. companies to non-market economies like China compromising our supply chain security and then subsequently our national security?
Thank you, Senator. I am not familiar with your the legislation that you put forward, but I will comment on the supply chain question, the latter part. I think it's very important. And we see just most recently with PPE and how unreliable some of those supplies were. A colleague of mine has done a lot of research on medical supply chains, and especially as we discuss, okay, how do we have pandemic responsiveness when our supply chain, especially for APIs, especially for some basic drugs, are not located here. And so I think that gets back to the comment that I made in my prepared remarks about as we're examining those supply chains, we really need to look at, okay, what is the best value for the nation as opposed to the lowest cost? But that also gets at some of the market access issues as well, because we have seen cases, and I actually put in my written testimony about cases where because of that market access, we have pharmaceutical companies that are sending or closing down those API or kind of your more basic drugs manufacturing here and actually manufacturing those in China. So with the draw of, okay, then they'll be able to sell some of their more lucrative materials there.
Thank you. Mr. Pottinger, any thoughts you have on
this? Thanks, Senator. Yeah, you know, I think that I laud the goal that you're pursuing here and with this legislation, which I haven't yet read, but the Department of Commerce has already declared six nations that are quote unquote adversaries of the United States. China's at the top of the list, together with others that you might imagine, Russia and Iran and a few others. One of the reasons that Beijing may have felt so confident it really didn't bat an eye before destroying almost $1 trillion in shareholder value in its publicly listed firms in the United States, was because it's getting tens of billions of dollars through other means from more passive sources in the United States. These are institutional investors who are passively tying their money in the form of bond purchases and stock purchases to indexes. These index providers are weighing Chinese companies much more heavily than they used to, even as China becomes less and less transparent of an ecosystem to invest in. Almost every American reporter has now been kicked out of China. We have no idea what's going on with Chinese companies, yet these index providers keep putting more prominent weighting on Chinese companies so that more and more passive investment, ultimately hundreds of billions of dollars, is going into Chinese stocks and bonds. That's a big problem. So I think if we had sort of an outbound CFIUS mechanism, that's definitely worth exploring. The others look at Hong Kong as well. Hong Kong has now unfortunately been turned into a typical Chinese city, and we should be treating them the way that we treat mainland China when it comes to inbound and outbound investment.
Thanks very much. Mr. Chairman, I'll submit a question for the record on intellectual property, but we'll do that for the record.
I think you're pursuing an interesting line of questioning, and I think what Mr. Pottinger just said there, it wasn't just the folks that went directly in to some of these companies who've lost all this value, but oftentimes the passive investors. And the thing is, these companies are not going to disappear. They may simply be replaced with more Chinese investors and a more compliant leadership in those firms. Senator Gillibrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Evanina, you were the head of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. In 2018, DOJ required state-sponsored media outlets like Xinhua News and China Global Television Network to register as foreign agents. Yet when Americans visit those websites, when Americans read or listen to watch those stories, there isn't even the most basic labeling information for the consumer that are visiting a foreign agent registered news site. This is true for Russia, too. Russian media outlets like Sputnik that run influence operations through radio shows in the U.S. are forced to register as foreign agents by DOJ, but no one notifies the Americans who are listening to the shows or who are reading their stories. And I think that's really irresponsible. Why is the burden on the U.S. consumer to go to the DOJ website to hunt down FARA filing forms to know where they're getting their information?
Senator, thanks for the question. And I think you were getting at the heart of what I believe to be the new frontier, which is malign foreign influence. And I think when we look at how countries like China and Russia facilitate their influence here, it starts with media. It manipulates social media, TV stations, newspaper, print, and we are unable to see it. And I will proffer that the U.S. government's inability to look at media due to constitutional issues provides a vast gaping hole for who should do that, right? I think it's unfair, as you said, for constituents to understand, and they're not going to go to DOJ website. But we don't have, I would reference, State Department has a global engagement center. We don't have a domestic engagement center to help advise and inform Americans as to how to identify where that influence is and what might be true or what not be, might not be true from that website. So I do think we have a hole to fill with respect to understanding malign foreign influence to help Americans' everyday living, technology, but also with elections in the future.
Where would you place that domestic engagement center? Under what agency?
Well, I would have to think more on that, Senator, but off the top of my head, I would say it would have to be partly in the intelligence community where it can garner the most real-time actionable intelligence from our collection. At the same time, it has to have a vehicle that could produce that intelligence unclassified to the consumers around America.
Right, because shouldn't this basic foreign agent information be affirmatively provided to American consumers so they can make informed decisions about where the foreign state-sponsored news is actually coming from?
Yes, and I, to that point, I think if you look at things from a an agency perspective of the goals, responsibilities, and the agency's names, I would say the Department of Homeland Security would be the right nomenclature for that kind of role.
So do you think that FARA needs to be strengthened or clarified in some of those loopholes that allow China and others to push their misinformation without any consumer protection notice?
Yes, I do think that any of these issues, whether it be FARA or FIRMA or CFIUS, should be looked at every year because the technology moves and how we see our adversaries change their tactics based upon legislation we employ or policies. We have to update that on a year-by-year basis to understand how China or Russia or Iran has revectored their influence so we can act accordingly.
I think that also should apply in some respects to our platforms, our social media platforms, because especially in a current example like the debate about vaccinations, a lot of Chinese and Russians are actively trying to mislead Americans. And I think there has to be some responsibility to the purveyors of this information to have a way to know if they are foreign agents. Do you agree?
I completely agree. And I look back the last year or so, as Mr. Pottinger had referenced, and as I went through with the election, the ability to siphon through malign foreign influence and messages that are factually not correct is a very difficult venue. And when you look at the abilities of our adversaries, Russia and China, to no longer cede information here, but to use our own information to amplify for other Americans, takes on its own new weight of a really difficult obstacle to be able to do that.
Ms. Puglisi, obviously foreign adversaries have tried to influence our country for a very long time. This is nothing new. Russia has attempted to steal our technology through investments, through exchange students, through cyber operations, attempted to recruit, tried to intimidate, stifle dissent, unflattering narratives, as does China. So obviously this is problematic and serious, but the question is, what aspects of this threat are new? And is it simply a question of scale and breadth of China's operations and theft of trade secrets that differentiate it? And how should these distinctions shape our strategy and counter their efforts?
Thank you, Senator, for that question. I would say the aspects that are new is that it's more and more in the civilian space. And I think if you raise the issue of the Soviet Union, when we look back on that, it was very heavily military-focused. And some of my earlier comments about how our traditional structure of CI is focused on intelligence officers, on things that were completely illegal, things that have a direct military application. And the way China targets our technologies and the way it leverages its own diaspora, I think, is something that's very new. It's also the scale and scope and the fact that these are central government programs that have been in place for decades, that focus on the influence piece, the civil technology piece, and really target the gray areas of our civil society. And you pair that with the largest crackdown on civil society that we're seeing in China under Xi, and it's a really toxic mix.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gillibrand. I just have one more question, and I know we've a series of six votes has started, and that's why some of my colleagues have, I think, gone back to the floor. One, I want to thank all three of you. But my sense, and some of I liked one of Matt's ideas a lot about all these of the 300, used to be 360,000, I think we're down to 320,000 Chinese students. Give every one of those students an American phone when they got here so they are not surveilled constantly. My sense of the Chinese economy and one of the challenges we have, frankly, for any American or for that matter, Western-based company, and I would point out that while this committee, I think, got ahead of the game a little bit on spotting 5G, it really came, the first signs of warning about Huawei didn't actually come as much from the intelligence community, came from places like Japan and South Korea and elsewhere. But it seems to me that the Chinese economy has allowed, and I don't know if that's changing dramatically now as we see the leadership and some of the value taken out of some of the most successful tech companies in these last few months, but for last 5 to 10 years, China would allow a ferocious level of competition, at least within the tech space. But that competition would be allowed until a national champion emerges, a la Huawei or ZTE. And once that, and in that space, no Western, no American, for that matter, any Western company could actually be on the competitive edge. They would never be allowed a Western or American company to kind of win in one of these new technology areas. Matter of fact, as we know, with Facebook being excluded or Google trying for a while and then leaving on their own accord and others. And the idea that Chinese technology winner, then suddenly, even if they're independent, gets the full backing of the state, Huawei, we've talked about $100 billion plus, is really an economic model, kind of an authoritarian capitalism model that I don't like, but it's had a pretty successful record recently. Because if you then combine that not only with the financial support, but also with the Belt and Road Initiative, the Digital Silk Road, China's increasing power around the world, you suddenly had a series of, well, maybe not satellite countries in the traditional mindset, at least countries that were dependent on China's forbearance because China happened to be also building a bridge or building a road in many of those countries. I think that model is hard to compete against. I think we've seen it as well, and I think this committee spent a lot of time looking around this issue, which I raised in my opening comments, around standards and rules of the game, again, within technology. Because I would argue that, I use the Sputnik example, but post-Sputnik, virtually every major technology innovation over the last 60 years, if it wasn't invented in America, we still got to set the rules and the standards and the protocols. And those rules, whether it was about transparency or respect for human rights, even in technology standards, you can embed some of your standards. It kind of crept up on us in 5G, and I say this as an old telecom guy, where suddenly it was China was flooding the zone on these international standard-setting bodies with engineers, with power, and they are, I would argue in many ways, on the 5G issue. They won the standard-setting component. And unfortunately, we're seeing, whether it's in AI or facial recognition or a host of areas where they have now had the audacity to lay out with great deal of specificity where they hope to dominate, they are being fairly successful. So the question I have for all three of you, and my last question is, I don't believe we can do this alone. I think some of our greatest strengths has been our alliances, that there is a moment in time where not just Five Eyes or not just NATO, but our democracies around the world. I would even argue that we may be entering in an era where post-World War II was an era of military alliances, NATO, CETO, a series of others. 60s and 70s of last century, started European Union being a classic example of economic alliances. I think in 2021 and going forward, we need to think about technology-based alliances. And those alliances ought to be based upon democracies who share those same sets of values and goals of democracy. And that needs to start in areas like standard setting. It is where we have actually finally put our money where our mouth is in terms of recent legislation that virtually everybody on this committee supported around support for semiconductors. And we did get a smaller slug in for 5G and O-RAN. But I'd ask all three of you, and I'll start, Anna, with you, then go to Bill, and then let Matt close out. You know, how should we think about this effort to get our allies better engaged with us as partners, not into this bifurcation choice that you either got to be on our side or China's side, but do this in some level of collaboration around technology development, around standard setting, around, again, promoting the a very alternative model to the authoritarian communism model or authoritarian capitalism model that China has frankly practiced fairly well.
Thank you, Senator. You raised some really important points. I want to highlight the model that you described is one that China has laid out for its strategic emerging industries. It's winning the China market first, creating that national champion, and then having that go out and compete on the world stage. And you know, talking about Huawei, I think, is a great example of that. What it highlights are those areas and what are those characteristics of these different industries where profit margins, national security, in some ways, go in opposite directions, and how do we actually compete with that? Because those industrial policies of our like-minded are very, very different in scale, scope, and flavor than what we're seeing with China. Forming those tech alliances will be, in my opinion, are very, very important. And it's looking out across how do we can't out-China-China, let's face it. We don't want to. We want to double down on the advantages of our own system. And that is working with our partners and allies in building those innovation hubs, finding those niche areas. Some countries will be set for tech alliances in certain areas, some in different technologies. But it's also, I think, it's part of that information sharing and risk calculation sharing that we should have those dialogues about what's at stake and how you know we can use technology for that are in line with our values and the values of our allies and partners.
Thank you. Bill?
Senator, first, thanks for having this hearing. I think it's really important for the American public to understand the issues that you and the Vice Chair brought to the openness since we hadn't closed hearings for a few years. I think your premise is right on our need to cooperate and collaborate with our allies. However, I will proffer that we need to lead in that collaboration. I think with respect to my colleague Anna's point, China's not gonna change. And I think it was one thing in DC that we have bipartisan support on is that China is going to be China and they're gonna double down. We have to make a decision in America, do we want to change the way we operate? We clearly are bifurcated for the right reasons between the government and the private sector. I'll proffer it's time to change the way we look at that and relook at how we are willing to change the construct for partnering with private sector, industry, technology to be able to build coalitions between our government first in industry and then show that leadership to our allies in Europe and other places so they could use that as a framework. We won that argument with Huawei for the same reason. I think the next step with technology is to do the same methodology, find champions in the U.S. and have the government partner with so that we look at China as a competitor, not just as an enemy, and we can compete, because we can't compete because we're America, and we will win if we may put our mind to it. Secondarily, as we did with Huawei, other countries and allies will watch and learn and do the same methodology in their own country to do the same diplomatic and technological solution. So I do think we have an opportunity here with allies if we change the way we do business here in the U.S.
Very good. Matt, and recognizing I've got to go run vote in a moment.
You bet. Thanks, Senator. Very quickly, I agree with you. I think your vision for these sort of coalitions around certain technologies, you know, coalitions of the willing, if you like, is the way that we need to go. And there's precedent for that. During the Cold War, we had what was called the Coordinating Committee, where industry in Japan and the United States and other allied countries made sure that the Soviet Union didn't gain access to our most cutting-edge semiconductor technology. Here we are again, and it's the same technology, it's semiconductors. We've got to win that race. Commerce needs to be brought firmly into the fold. The Bureau of Industry and Security has to be really treated and think like a national security arm of the U.S. government, not a trade promotion arm if we're going to win on semiconductors. We've got to make peace with the Europeans on these privacy issues and these things that we're tied up with. Right now, the Europeans are very inconsistent in how they're viewing privacy. They're targeting American technology giants, but they're not applying the same standards to Chinese companies, which are going to be truly harmful to the interests of Europeans and disrespectful of people's privacy, of their data, and so forth. So that's an area where we need to break through. But I think I agree with you. With those kinds of coalitions, even if it's not one neat global approach, but one of different coalitions, I think we're unbeatable.
Well, thank you all. Just two quick last comments. One, to not just American industry, but all of the Western industry that is invested in China, if we can. No problem with that, as long as it's not at the price of your values, as long as you do not surrender to, as Senator Rubio pointed out, that you turn a blind eye to human rights abuses, or you are willing to be co-opted into taking policies that you would not take, not only in the United States, but for that matter, any other country in the world. That we have to be constantly consistent on. And I think the business community needs to continue to hear these messages in these open settings and, as appropriate, in closed settings as well, so even further information can be shared. And then last point, and I, again, very much appreciate all three of the witnesses that in your opening statements you all hit on this point, and that is this beef, our concern, our challenge is with the Communist Party of China and its leadership. And any forces in this country that instead play into broad-based racist or xenophobic statements about the Chinese people, the Chinese diaspora, Chinese Americans, Asian Americans, frankly, do a disservice to our country and our values, but also play right in to the CCP's agenda that you can never be, that the only place you will ever have a firm and permanent home is back in China. I think we, and I say this here for speaking on behalf of all the senators on this dais who are here today, need to redouble our efforts to make that distinction and to make sure that particularly law enforcement, and I've spent a lot of time with Director Ray on this issue, that the FBI and others reach out on a very regular basis to the Chinese-American diaspora in this country. They are under, as so many, Bill, as you've made comments, under a level of pressure sometimes that is extraordinary. And They are great Americans, and they've contributed enormously to our country. But we need them in this challenge against the Communist Party's ideology. And, you know, and any observant person, you know, doesn't need, I don't think, further proof, because you see the very nature of the treatment of the Uyghurs or the treatment of the people of Hong Kong. We need to keep that lesson and continue to make that point. I thank all of you for your contribution. There is much, much more to be discussed. We could have had a whole separate hearing just looking at the individual technologies that China's investing in and trying to outcompete us. We'll have that opportunity. With that, hearing's adjourned. Thank you all.